Welcome to Prussian Socialism, bringing you culture, whether you like it or not. Now, there are two basic ways to approach the question of culture and of how to develop culture, how to sustain a high culture. There's the liberal approach and there's the National Socialist approach. The liberal approach says that we need to have a solid culture because this will lead to better political outcomes. The National Socialist approach says the other way around. We need to have a strong political regime, an just political regime, in order for culture to flourish whatsoever. Take, for example, let's look at history and try to identify some of the periods where there was high cultural flourishing. There was Greece of the 5th and 4th centuries BC. There was Northern Italy of the Renaissance era. There was the Germany and the German-speaking lands in the 19th century. There was also France in the, say, the 18th century, the 17th century. England had its moment of glory in the 19th century as well, culturally. And we could go through other countries as well outside of the Western world and identify some other times. But scholars for a long time have tried to look and identify what is the political regime where you can have culture. And if we look at ancient Greece and the Renaissance, we'd say, well, it probably has something to do with having small government, small republics, small states. This seems to allow for the greatest amount of cultural flourishing. And I think the founding fathers of the United States were very much of that opinion. Because if you look at big empires like the Roman Empire or the Han Dynasty in China or the Abbasid Caliphate or something, what you almost never in these sorts of states find such a concentration of cultural flourishing, of art, of literature, of philosophy, the way you do in some of these periods of small state dominance. Or little collections of states that all share the same culture and whose intellectuals are exchanging some of the same ideas. Now, that is a simplification, of course. In Rome, in the first century BC, the first century AD, you had the golden and silver ages of Latin literature. You had Virgil and Cicero and Horace and Ovid. And you can certainly have this. I mean, and sort of a similar thing prevailed in the Abbasid Caliphate with some of the great Arabic poetry and history was being written about that time. And in the Roman example, too, with history, you've got Tacitus, you've got, Plutarch, biography history, and you've got some other history writers, Juvenal, Sallust, some others. But what is really interesting about the small state periods, about your classical Greece, your Renaissance Italy, your German states in the 19th century, 18th century, is that you have often a higher degree of cultural flourishing, and cultural flourishing in areas that aren't merely formal but are more substantive. So with the Roman example, you have history and poetry are the two main art forms represented. And perhaps also architecture. Well, that's arguable. I won't talk about architecture because I don't know much about it. But I won't say architecture. The Romans built a lot, but the great architectural forms were established by the Greeks. So the Greeks really have it on architecture. But they also have it on philosophy, and we can't really point to any great Roman philosophy. I mean, I don't count Seneca or Marcus Aurelius as great philosophers on the level of Plato or Aristotle. And we don't have some of the real pathological, I don't mean that in the bad sense that it's usually used in English, the real deep drama of Greek drama, stage performances, or Greek poetry. We don't see that same level of depth achieved by the later Roman artists, because these Roman artists were more focused on the technique. And they did produce lasting and beautiful works, but it isn't quite the same as the real burst of genius that happened in Greece, in the Greek city-states in the 4th and 5th centuries BC. Taking that back to the political question of the liberal approach to culture and the National Socialist approach. The National Socialist approach to culture would say that culture is downstream of politics. You need political order. You need the state and the people to be politically ordered, and you need for there to be some stability in order for culture to flourish. So to see this, the National Socialist attitude being that you need political order to have real high culture, I'll give you the a reading here from Mein Kampf, page 298 of the Ralph Manheim edition, everybody's favorite Jew. And before I read this, I should point out, so Hitler's opinion is a little bit more subtle than just you need political order to have culture. His opinion is that you need to have idealism, you need to cultivate idealism, and that needs to be done. The political order, idealism is a precondition for political order, but the political order also needs to cultivate idealism, and that in turn leads to high culture. So he says, our own German language possesses a word which magnificently designates this kind of activity, Pflichterfüllung, fulfillment of duty. It means not to be self-sufficient, but to serve the community. The basic attitude from which such activity arises, we call, to distinguish it from egoism and selfishness, idealism. By this, we understand only the individual's capacity to make sacrifices for the community, for his fellow man. So I'll just insert right there myself. When Hitler says idealism, he doesn't mean in the technical philosophical sense of that word. He means in the common use of that word, where idealism means putting other things before yourself, believing in something bigger than yourself. That's what he's talking about here. How necessary it is to keep realizing that idealism does not represent a superfluous expression of emotion, but that in truth it has been, and always will be, the premise for what we designate as human culture. Yes, that idealism alone created the concept of man. It is to this inner attitude that the Aryan owes his position in this world, and to it the world owes man. For it alone formed the pure spirit and the creative force which, by a unique pairing of the brutal fist and the intellectual genius, created the monuments of human culture. Okay, so typically Hitlerian sentence, very, very, lots of subordinate clauses and stuff there. But what he's saying is that you need to have the brutal fist, so politics, organization, and you need to have idealism in order for there to be culture at all. Now, I bring up this Hitler point not just to justify the motto of the show, bring you culture, whether you like it or not, but to lead into a discussion of a book I just read that I absolutely hated. This book is The German Catastrophe by Friedrich Meinecke. Friedrich Meinecke was a German scholar of the late 19th and mostly the 20th century. He had quite a long life. He mainly did his work from circa 1900 until circa 1950. And his first big work was, the one that got him noticed was a book called Cosmopolitanism and the National State. And this was written before World War I. And he had a long career throughout World War I, through the Weimar years. And then he got kicked out of, well, I'm not sure if he was kicked out or if he just sort of left. He retired from university in 1933, the year of the re-Germanization of the German state. And then he came back into academia after Germany was destroyed and taken over by the Allies. So as you can imagine, this guy was a political liberal, at least in his later life. The German Catastrophe itself, I'm going to talk a little bit more about Meinecke because he's a interesting character, but the German Catastrophe itself was written in 1946, so right after the war ended, and it's a fairly short book. It's been about 100 pages or so, and to me, it's quite clear that Meinecke's intention in writing this was to come up with a bunch of copes for liberalism and to get himself, to angle himself for a new job in university system, which he obtained a few years later when he was appointed the dean of the University of Berlin, but not the University of not the old University of Berlin, because that was in the Soviet sector. He got a job at the new Zag University of Berlin, which I think is called the new University of Berlin, which was in the Western sector. And he basically, he's just an apologist for liberalism. And so whenever you deal with a work of this kind, you're reading kind of the regime's, the system's explanation of how it sees the world. And it can be very frustrating reading this stuff because there are a lot of interesting points made, but the entire structure of the argument misses several like core assumptions, and it basically doesn't even address the actual National Socialist philosophy. It simply sidesteps it and puts up strawman arguments to then destroy and then say, see, liberalism is correct. Now, I do think the book is, I'm giving it I'm being a little bit overly critical because I wouldn't even talk about it if it were written by a Jew, because there are many books of this type, histories of German philosophy and of German literature that were written by Jews and that basically try to explain German history in terms of how did Hitler come about. I may have mentioned this, I definitely mentioned this before on the show. It's the so-called Sonderweg hypothesis. That is the alternate way that Germany took from the other nations of Europe. And there are a number, or this is a very popular academic interpretation for a long time. I think it's some people still subscribe to it. And the Sonderweg hypothesis is, I think, on its face, ridiculous. To say that German history leading to Hitler is somehow like totally different than the other nations of Europe, I mean, it incorporates the idea that there's different forms of the hypothesis. One version says that that Hitler came about in Germany because the middle class arose in Germany a little bit later than it did in Britain and in France, and therefore you didn't have a liberal type revolution like you did in France in 1789, or like you kind of did in Britain with the English Civil War, or arguably like you did in Britain with the American Revolution, which was sort of a liberalistic middle-class revolution, even if it didn't carry over into England and it just restricted itself to the colonies. You could say that, well, the English-speaking, the Western European countries of Britain and France, America, kind of had this rise of the middle class and then a transition to a liberal system, whereas Germany never had that. And I think to uphold that hypothesis, you really have to really limit your understanding of world history to, well, Britain, France, America, and Germany. You sort of have to ignore every other country in Europe to say that Germany is abnormal in that regard. But getting back to Meinecke, Meinecke wants to interpret the National Socialist period in Germany and the National Socialist philosophy as an aberration from what had come before in German thought and development since about the time of Goethe. And to do this, he makes a number of points, one of which is he talks about terrible simplificateur, which I think is French for terrible simplifiers. And this was a phrase used by Swiss historian Jacob Burckhardt. And what Burckhardt was talking about was this idea that because of the Industrial Revolution and because of the great increase in population in European countries since about 1800, he foresaw, and this is the 1890s, 1880s, he foresaw that European civilization would go toward a stage more like Roman civilization in the time of Caesar. You would have to have mass leaders who came up with simplifications of history and simplifications of politics in order to control so many people. You could no longer have such a complicated and organically grown society like you had up until about 1800. Now, since the French Revolution or so, history has started to require more brutal and more direct forms of control. And so Burckhardt was afraid of that. And Meinecke points out Burckhardt and says Burckhardt was right. And Hitler is an example of this terrible simplification that we've seen in politics. and we need to move away from that. His other main point, or one of his other main points, is about, to back up the idea of terrible simplification, is the German military culture of Prussia and then through the time of World War II. In the military culture, he sees a really great leveling, that the military, the militarism, the emphasis on strength and discipline had caused a change in the values of the whole society that led to less culture and simple mechanical obedience. So with both of those two things, I'm going to say a lot about both of those two things. I'm going to read a lot of, a few quotes from the book and explain what he's saying and why I think he's absolutely wrong, and also why I think he hasn't even read Mein Kampf and isn't even attacking Hitler's actual positions. But let me go back a second and talk a little bit more about Meinecke and his background. So Meinecke was a scholar who kind of went with the times. In the era before World War I, he was a huge proponent of German colonization of the East and of assimilation or reduction of the Slavs in the East. And take whatever opinion you will on that, but that certainly seems to be at odds with the opinions that he's taking in the book, in this 1946 book, The German Catastrophe. Meinecke was also a product, a pure product of the university. He didn't do anything else. He didn't have any other career. He was totally a professional historian. And you see this in the arguments that he produces in German Catastrophe, because the entire structure of the argument ignores several crucial factors, in addition to strawmanning National Socialism and confusing politics with ethics. He ignores the question of geography. So he ignores the possibility that maybe the state, the German state, needed to be very militaristically organized simply to survive. He doesn't even address that possibility. He also ignores the major factor of all Western history since circa 1900, and that is Jewish power. He simply doesn't acknowledge that Jews are powerful in America and in Britain and in Germany in the Weimar years and Germany after the war. It's to him, he does talk about the Jews a little bit, and he says some things that nowadays he wouldn't be allowed to, and he's probably gotten criticized by more modern people for the kinds of things he was saying, but he doesn't understand the magnitude, or he pretends not to, perhaps, understand the magnitude of Jewish power. So he isn't really dealing with the actual political world. What he's dealing with is this construct that he wants the world to be. So he confuses is and ought. He doesn't look at, here's what world politics is, and taking what politics are, now let's decide what objectives we want, what we want to be true, what we want to bring into the world, what we think would be the best outcome, and what is the most ethical way to get there. He simply says, and practical way to get there, he simply says, well, it would be nice if the world, if we didn't have to fight the communists, if we didn't have to deal with the Jewish question, if we didn't have to deal with the geographical problem of Germany's position in the middle of Europe and being surrounded by other states that have competing interests with it. He simply doesn't address the question. All right, so let's go ahead and get right into Professor Meinecke's argument here. So this is from the very beginning of the book, chapter one. He talks about the two waves of the age, and these are nationalism and socialism. And before I read it, I will say he does have here, the book is not worth reading. Don't read the book. I read it for you, and I'll tell you the important parts. I mean, I guess you can read it if you want to, but honestly, there's just a lot of better stuff you could read. But he does have a useful observation here that nationalism and socialism were the two main ethical and political waves, phenomena of the 19th century, and that Germany's problem, and actually Europe's problem in general, was how to bring these two waves into agreement with one another in order to establish a functional political system that could take into account all the stuff that had happened since 1800 and the Industrial Revolution and the explosion of population. So he says at the beginning, the question of the deeper causes of the frightful catastrophe which burst upon Germany, you know, the war, will still occupy the coming centuries, provided these centuries are indeed still able and inclined to ponder problems of this kind. But then the question of the German catastrophe broadens at the same time to a question which extends beyond Germany to the destiny of the West in general. Hitler's National Socialism, which brought us directly into this abyss, is not a phenomenon deriving from merely German evolutionary forces, but as also certain analogies and precedents in other authoritarian systems, however horribly peculiar Nazism presents itself as an example of degeneration in the German character. So right here, he isn't quite one of those people who believes in the Sonderweg hypothesis. He thinks that this is a wider problem of the Western world, but in a way, I guess he's with the Sonderweg hypothesis because he thinks that Nazism itself is, well, actually, no, he's totally against it. Correction. He's totally against it because he thinks Nazism is a deviation from the true development of the German intellectual and philosophical potential, and that Germany and the West share this common problem of how to deal with modern society. So he goes on. But one asks further, how could this take place? This astonishing deviation from the main lines of a European development, which was apparently moving towards some kind of free individualistic and binding collectivist elements, making toward the preservation of the liberal gains in the 19th century. Instead of a liberal tendency, there came the precipitate shift to despotism, the rise of the terrible simplificateurs, whom Jacob Burckhardt, more than half a century ago, saw coming. Burckhardt, more clear-sighted than any other thinker of his time, also gives the first answers to our problem, which he understood in its appearance. In the optimistic illusions of the Age of Enlightenment, the 18th century, and the French Revolution, he already perceived the germ of the great disease, the mistaken striving after the unattainable happiness of the masses of mankind, which then shifted into a desire for profits, power, and a general striving for living well. So there came about, Burckhardt further observes, the loosening of the old social ties and ultimately the creation of new but very powerful ties by those men of violence, the terrible simplificateurs, who, supported by military organizations, forced the masses back again into discipline and obedience and a renunciation of all their former longings for freedom. In the misery of their daily existence, they could then be called to position every morning by the beat of the drum and evening led home by the beat of the drum. This all should sound vaguely familiar to you because these are the typical liberal arguments against National Socialism. The first one that he's making is a straw man. He's saying that National Socialism is just like communism. It's another totalitarian system that seeks to simplify affairs, the state, the society, so much that it destroys the value of the individual. That's his core argument here. And it's such a typical, obnoxious, cloying liberal argument. And reading it, one has to ask oneself, did this guy even read Mein Kampf? Because there are many, many, many quotes throughout Mein Kampf where Hitler says quite the opposite. And I'll read those to you in a second here. But the other thing, too, is one you have to ask yourself, does this guy, has Meinecke, I mean, he could make the argument that, well, the theory of National Socialism says that there's value in the individual. The practice is otherwise. But he doesn't make that argument. He simply washes over both possibilities, and he sets up a straw man of National Socialism being the same as Bolshevism, as Soviet communism, where every person is reduced to being simply a tool of the state. So let me read you some quotes from Mein Kampf that directly go against what Meinecke claims National Socialism is. Here we have page 448 of, again, our favorite Jew, Ralph Mannheim. He says, Hitler says, in Ralphie's words, the Folkish philosophy is basically distinguished from the Marxist philosophy, Bolshevism, communism, by the fact that it not only recognizes the value of race, but with it the importance of the personality, which it therefore makes one of the pillars of its entire edifice. These are the factors which sustain its view of life. Okay. Next page, Hitler says, And accordingly, the Folkish state, National Socialist state, must free all leadership, and especially the highest, that is political leadership, entirely from the parliamentary principle of majority rule. In other words, mass rule. And instead, absolutely guarantee the right of personality. From this, the following realization results. The best state constitution and state form is that which, with the most unquestioned certainty, raises the best minds in the national community to leading position and leading influence. So Hitler is saying that, yes, we value the individual. And it isn't, it also isn't the other thing. It isn't the opposite extreme of libertarianism, where libertarianism would hold that individualism, absolute selfishness, and Randian selfishness is the best because that will lead to the best outcomes, which is a ridiculous and Jewish notion. The National Socialist philosophy, as y'all know, is summed up in the phrase Gemeinnutz geht vor Eigennutz. The common good goes before the individual good. And balancing those two things is actually what National Socialism seeks to do. And if you look at liberalism, if you look at the system that has prevailed in the West, and Hitler's talking about that in that quote I just read about parliamentarianism. Parliamentarianism simply imposes the mass opinions because, well, a parliamentarian has to go with whatever is popular or whatever his money masters make him do. And there is therefore no room for individual responsibility and no room for individual achievement within a democracy, quote unquote democracy, which is actually a totalitarian system. Now, on that last Hitler quote, before we keep going with Meinecke's arguments here, I do want to point out between this Hitler quote and the first one I read you about selfishness and about idealism. So National Socialism, you know, Hitler said in that last quote that that political leadership has to be in control of the people with the best minds. Now, one could take that and say, well, therefore we need to have IQ supremacy. We need to have the smartest people in the government, and that's that. We could just IQ test everybody and put them in charge and we'd have a better state. Hitler is not saying that. He is absolutely not saying that. Take it with the first quote I read you about idealism. What Hitler wants in the leadership of the state are the people who have that combination of idealism, of readiness to sacrifice themselves for the good of the community, and intelligence. Intelligence isn't something that means you deserve to rule. Intelligence means that you are responsible, that you have a duty to use your intelligence to the best effect for your race. That's Hitler's opinion. And Meinecke simply doesn't even address that. Now, one of the other things Meinecke touches on in that quote is this notion of a moral and cultural degeneration. He thinks that Nazism, National Socialism, is a moral cultural degeneration from the time of Goethe. And there's a number of ways one could approach this. I mean, it's hard to say that the mid-20th century was a greater era of art and philosophy than the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries, especially in Germany. Clearly, the time of Kant and Goethe and Schiller and Fichte was a higher cultural peak than the 20th century. But to blame that all on Nazism is ridiculous. The 1890s, likewise, were very poor in cultural output. And I mean, at least in the deep philosophical sense, so he was talking about like with Athenian democracy or something, with that really deep philosophical and artistic culture. Yeah, sure, the 1890s were a decline from the 1810s. And it's funny because actually Meinecke, in one of the quotes in here, he mentions, he quotes, I think it was Fontaine, talking about how degenerate the 1890s were. And it's like, yeah, I mean, that just goes to prove the point that it wasn't National Socialism that brought about this decline. National Socialism was an attempt to politically form the society in such a way that culture would again be possible on the level of Goethe and Schiller. Moving on to one of the other Hitler quotes that directly repudiates or refutes this notion by Meinecke that National Socialism is just another kind of Marxism, we have from page 91 of Mein Kampf, one of my favorite quotes, and I've read it before, but this one talks about leadership and who is appropriate to be a leader and how that like fits with individuality. So Hitler says, in truly Germanic democracy is characterized by the free election of a leader and his obligation fully to assume all responsibility for his actions and omissions. In it, there is no majority vote on individual questions, but only the decision of an individual who must answer with his fortune and his life for his choice. So is that not a fairer way? Is that not a more just way and a more noble way to decide political questions than parliamentarianism? Because Meinecke mentions in there that he wants, I don't know if he said it somewhere in the book that you need parliamentary checks in order to assure individual, the free development of the individual, which is really ridiculous and is refuted by the last 80 years of Western civilization, where we've had, well, no culture, or completely degenerate modernist culture, lack of feeling, a complete leveling of the culture among the whole people of Western Europe and of America. I mean, it to say that parliamentarianism leads to higher culture is just ridiculous, and history bears that out. But Hitler goes on, thank the Lord, Germanic democracy means just this, that any old climber or moral slacker cannot raise by devious paths to govern his national comrades, but that by the very greatness of the responsibility to be assumed, incompetence and weaklings are frightened off. But if nevertheless one of these scoundrels should attempt to sneak in, we can find him more easily and mercilessly challenge him. Out, out, cowardly scoundrel, remove your foot, you're besmirching the steps. The front steps of the pantheon of history are not for sneak thieves, but for heroes. And that, you know, in National Socialism, not only applies to the leader of the state, but it applies to all the subordinate leaders, all the ministers, all of the military officers, all the leaders of corporations. Everybody is a leader subordinate to, well, not everybody's a leader, but all the mid-level and high-level leaders are subordinate to the national leader, but they too have responsibility within their own spheres. Is this not individuality? Is this not value of the person? All right, so let's go on with some of Monica's other arguments, because that beginning was quite weak. And, you know, the problem with arguing with someone like Monica is just that it's impossible to have a debate with somebody who doesn't share basic assumptions. So like I said earlier, Monica doesn't share our assumption, well, our observation of obvious truth, that Jews are powerful in the Western world. In fact, the most powerful faction. He doesn't share the observation that Germany's geographical position would lead to the necessity of a highly organized and disciplined military. He doesn't share the assumption that the social question, that is the matter of a population explosion since 1800, needs to be solved, and that you can't simply fall back on older forms like Monica would want us to do. He wants a continuation of the ancien regime. He doesn't quite say that, but that's in effect what he's saying when he talks about Burkhardt and how these terrible simplifiers of the future, of the current day in 1940s, that these people are bad. It's like, well, you need to have some kind of political solution. And what he also never addresses is, he confuses the idea of ends and means. So National Socialism says, look, we've got a problem with these communists here. The communists have a very effective message. They have very good propaganda. They're winning over the sympathies of the people. In order to fight communism, we need to beat them at their own game. We need to use their methods for good ends. If the communists are using lies and preaching lies in order to get people to believe in the Marxist system, which is objectively evil, we need to first discern what the truth is and what a better system would be, And then we need to win people over to our side. And once we've won them over to our side through propaganda, then we need to educate them to make them understand what the truth is. We can't just do what someone like Meineke, a classical liberal or a conservative, would do and go to the people and say, well, here's actually how the world works, and give them long lectures. Because if they're not on our side, if they haven't fallen in with us in their sympathies, then they're not going to be prepared to listen. So it is actually, in Hitler's opinion, immoral to not do propaganda and to not try to win the people over. And yes, if you have to simplify things and break it down into slogans, well, that's what the Marxists are doing. In the same way that it's not immoral to defend yourself with a weapon when somebody attacks you with a weapon, and the social level, it's not immoral to use propaganda to fight against somebody who's using propaganda to win over the sympathies of the people for something evil when you're trying to win them over for something good. It's basic common sense. I mean, sorry, not common sense. I've said, well, y'all know what the word common sense means. Common sense means a simplification of truth. Sorry, I don't want to get pedantic here. There's instinct, there's common sense, and then there's a sophisticated understanding of truth. Common sense, as it's used in the English-speaking world, is often nowadays used to mean instinct. But what common sense, when Germans talk about common sense, what they're talking about is saying something like, we should have gay marriage because two people, any person deserves to marry whoever they want to. Because as long as it isn't hurting anybody else, anything should be allowed. This is the Spencerian, not that Spencer, the 19th century Spencer. This is the Spencerian, like, morality, is do whatever you want as long as you're not hurting anybody else. And it's ridiculous. That's common sense. We're not talking about common sense here. We're talking about instinct. Instinctually, this makes sense. And it's that meme of, like, the grug brain and the autist genius agreeing on things, but then the person in the with the middle IQ has some stupid idea that's completely different from the lower end of the IQ spectrum, the high end. It's that same concept. But sorry, I'm going off on kind of random things here. Let's get back to Meineke's argument. So he talks about the military culture of Germany. And this is just really rich coming from a guy who wasn't in the military at all and doesn't seem to have understood the military mindset, doesn't seem to have understood any soldier at all, for him to talk about the military mindset. But he criticizes the Prussian military and talks about Prussianism for being too simplifying and too brutal and being adverse to culture. And, I mean, to be fair to Meineke, I think he does have a little bit of a point. I feel like if I lived in 19th century Germany, I would be quite critical of some of the... I'm sure there are plenty of bullheaded, like, jackasses in the Prussian army who were complete assholes and everybody hated and had inflated social status even though they didn't deserve it. I'm sure there is plenty of that. That happens in all societies where you have this sort of thing. But Meineke doesn't take into account that perhaps evils like that, perhaps having a few lieutenants strutting around town thinking that they're the shit and being, you know, he has one quote in here. He talks about the young lieutenant in the Prussian military before World War I was like a young god. And, you know, perhaps that's a tolerable social evil if your country is in the middle of Europe and might need to fight France or Austria or Russia or England, or maybe all of them at the same time. Perhaps that's a tolerable social evil, and perhaps that's something that you need to have in order to, as Hitler says, maintain the political order to allow the development of culture in the first place. You can't have culture if you're under foreign occupation. Although Meineke, in the conclusion of this book, argues the opposite. So on the matter of the military, let's look at what Meineke has to say. This is from page 10 of German Catastrophe. In the Prussian state of Frederick William I and Frederick the Great, so the mid to late 1700s, there lived two souls, one capable of culture and the other hostile to culture. The Prussian army, as created by Frederick William I, brought forth a remarkably penetrating militarism that influenced all civil life and found its like in no neighboring state. However, as early as the travel sketches of Montesquieu, who lived in Hanoverian territory near the Prussian frontier, we find some unpleasant things about it. The question of the origin of Prussian militarism we can leave to one side. We wish to inquire here only into its influence on German destiny as a whole in the 19th century. So then he goes on to talk about a paragraph of blah, 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 wars of liberation, Humboldt, yada, yada. But then on the next page, we have the point here. However, in the era when the empire, he means the Reich, was founded, the aspects of Prussian militarism, which were bad and dangerous for the general well-being, were obscured by the imposing proof of its power and discipline in the service of national unity and the construction of Bismarck's empire. So, you know, 19th century. The military man now seemed to be a consecrated spirit. The lieutenant moved through the world as a young god, and the civilian reserve lieutenant at least as a demigod. He had to rise to be a reserve officer in order to exert his full influence in the upper middle class world and above all in the state administration. Thus, militarism penetrated civilian life. Well, yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I will agree that that's kind of annoying. And the funny thing is, you see that now in America, where if you're a white guy, the only way to have any influence in the government is to have a successful military career as a junior officer. Well, or as an enlisted man. I mean, look at J.V. Vance there. But effectively, like, democracy actually has about as much militarism as they did. I mean, we have this same thing where there is a sort of weird militarism where, I mean, united with diversity, whatever, side point. Anyway, going on with his thing here, he has another sentence or two. Thus, militarism penetrated civilian life. Thus, there developed a conventional Prussianism, a naive self-admiration of the Prussian character, and together with it, serious narrowing of intellectual and political outlook. Everything was dissolved into rigid conventionalism. Well, that's very interesting, Professor, because yes, I could certainly see that criticism, but again, he completely ignores the military problem, the geostrategic problem of Germany in the 19th century and early 20th century. It makes sense if you're Germany to develop a highly technically proficient military to use as a tool to implement whatever your foreign policy needs to be to protect the state. But what he ignores in this whole argument is the fact, he's strawmanning again, is what he's doing. I don't think it would have been possible for Germany between 1866 and 1918 to perform the way it did on the battlefield were it not for actually a fairly well-developed sense of individualism within the German army. And this is what was called after 1918, after World War I, as Auftragstaktik. And I've talked about this before. This is what, if you know or are familiar with American military terminology, is called mission tactics. It's the top leader picks the mission, the subordinate leaders then get the overall idea, and then they implement the idea according to their local conditions. So it's it is a power structure where authority is delegated out to the individual leaders. It is not a monomaniacal, top-down, total control of everything. The lieutenant is responsible for his platoon and for his mission within the overall mission of the company, which is, in turn is responsible for its overall mission within, you know, the battalion, and so on. And I think this is proven by the fact of Germany's military successes from 1866 until 1945. And I say successes to include World War I and World War II because even though they lost, it was still 70 million Germans versus the whole world. So the fact that they didn't lose immediately is actually testament to the incredibly highly developed sense of individualism in the German army. Now, Meinecke, being a nerd, he makes another argument that kind of aligns with this one. So he talks about how the German army, how this Prussianism not only was annoying because you had these young studs strutting around in the street, like showing off their medals, and that was annoying, but also because it led to a destruction of the academic and intellectual culture of Prussia. And I don't know where he's getting this idea from, because glancing at a list of the great minds in philosophy, in history, in art, and in intellectual history of the period of, you know, 1850 or 1800 up until 1945, you find a lot of them being from Prussia. And even if we exclude, you know, the other German states prior to 1870, we still have quite a list of great German or great Prussian thinkers flourishing at universities like Berlin and Königsberg. So, for instance, the number one name that everyone should have on the top of their head when you say Königsberg is Immanuel Kant. Probably, this is my personal opinion, but the greatest philosopher since Aristotle. Other people I know think that. Some people think Kant was awful. I don't pretend to understand Kant, but I do know that he was a big deal. And he was able to flourish in Königsberg under Prussian administration. Let's see who else we have in Prussia in this period. So, University of Berlin, Friedrich Schleiermacher, philosopher and theologian, played a role in the founding of the University of Berlin, central figure in modern Protestant theology and hermeneutics. George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, of course, Hegel. A lot of people have bad opinions of Hegel, but no one can doubt that he was a key philosopher, thinker, a great mind, very influential of the early 19th century. Arthur Schopenhauer died 1860. Through his time at Berlin was brief. Schopenhauer's presence. Okay, so he taught at Berlin a little bit. Major influential historian, Leopold von Ranke, historian. He's the guy who came up with a thesis that Western culture is the synthesis of Latin culture and Germanic culture after the fall of Rome. He's also the guy responsible for the idea of the research university, no big deal. He's also the guy responsible for essentially like the modern approach to history writing and professional history writing. I mean, David Irving is writing in the Rankean tradition. Other people, Theodor Mommsen, the other great historian of the 19th century, leading classical scholar and historian, worked at University of Berlin, Nobel Prize Literature in 1902. Heinrich von Treitschke. Now, here's a guy, another historian, who is not terribly known in the English-speaking world, probably because he was a raging anti-Semite, but he wrote a history of the 19th century. I think it ends around 1850 or so. It's five volumes long. He wrote a bunch of other stuff as well. Nationalist historian and political writer, Treitschke held a chair in Berlin and was a prominent public intellectual. Max Planck, physicist, groundbreaking contributions, quantum theory. That's all University of Berlin. University of Halle, Martin Luther, University of Wittenberg. We have nobody terribly important. University of Königsberg, Kant, Herder, philosopher, theologian, literary critic. Herder studied at Königsberg under Kant, became a key figure in the Sturm und Drang movement and Romanticism. And Breslau, Jacob Grimm, Grimm's fairy tales, but probably more importantly, one of the key figures in the study of linguistics, and particularly he was the guy who discovered the Grimm's Law, that is the sound shift relationship between Germanic languages and other Indo-European languages. Maybe not discovered. I think Rask discovered it, but Grimm codified it. And then we have University of Bonn, Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, count that. Heinrich Heine, Jew, don't count that. But at any rate, I just read off some of that list to point out to you that I think it's ridiculous of Meinecke to claim that Prussianism, that the Prussian system, the Prussian state, led to a degeneration of culture when some of the greatest minds of the 19th century worked in Prussia. I mean, granted, not all of them did. Goethe worked at Weimar, Schiller as well. So there are some notable absences. But also Fichte was at University of Berlin as well. So how are you going to claim that Prussianism, that Prussia as a state, led to a degeneration of the culture. That's ridiculous. One might say that there was a certain degeneration in culture across Europe between 1830 and 1930. I think that's fair. But to say that it was Prussia's fault is ridiculous. And indeed, if we look to before 1780, so really the area before the era of Frederick the Great, and Frederick the Great became king, I think, in the 1740s, 1750s. If we look to before the era when Frederick the Great had really established Prussia as a great power, what do we find in Germany that's worthy of the name culture? We could say Leibniz. But that's one name. I mean, obviously a very great name and someone who's completely underrated in the Western world. But Leibniz invented calculus. Isaac Newton, no, Leibniz invented it. Well, I guess they both co-invented it. But Leibniz's notation is the one that's used today in calculus, not Newton's kind of weird notation. But other than Leibniz, like, I mean, you could say Martin Luther. You could say there are obviously other great Germans before then. But the real, like, high point in German culture happened in the 19th century. And a lot of that happened in Prussia. Some of it happened in the other German states as well. But Prussia, I think it's safe to say, allowed for the flourishing of these other states and allowed for the flourishing, therefore, of this intellectual culture that led to these great breakthroughs. Now, the other way to approach this question, contra Meinecke, would be to ask ourselves, well, if Meinecke is against this idea of, he doesn't want to develop the mid-level of society as much. He doesn't want there to be too much emphasis on technical proficiency within the military, because this will lead to cultural degeneracy, as he sees it. I would ask Professor Meinecke, well, how do you explain the greatness of Britain in the 19th century? Was it as a result of their, certainly largely a result of their head start on colonization, their defeat of the French in the Seven Years' War and so on, but was it not in part due to the greatness of the British aristocracy and the technical proficiency of their navy and of their mid-level administration and leadership? I mean, at least a little bit. That must have been part of it. Because the British, I think, like the Romans, recognized that you can't always pick who your national leader is going to be. You can't always ensure the highest quality in the national leadership. Sometimes you get somebody who comes into power as the consul or the king or whatever, who is a total moron. But we can at least control the education and the training and development and the standardization of our mid-level leadership. I mean, that's what made Rome great, was it not? Roman consuls and emperors were all over the place, but Rome had a consistent quality within its mid-level administration and its military leadership, and that's what made it great. So doesn't it make sense that we should try to replicate that in Germany? Well, no. Meinecke disagrees. So here is page 42, talking about the Prussian General Staff and the Schlieffen Plan. Meinecke says, however efficient the Prussian-German militarism, which culminated in the General Staff, proved itself to the very end to be, its efficiency was achieved through a dangerous one-sidedness. This disturbed the balance between rational and irrational motives. The purely military objective stood uppermost in its thinking and wishing. The war and the military system ought not to become ends in themselves, but should remain functional servants of the total life of a nation, and not only of one nation, but in the family of nations. That's stupid, but ignore that. That many perhaps have been recognized in theory by the wisest heads of the General Staff, but in practice it fell into the background in General Staff thinking. The General Staff was deficient in the necessary complementary political thinking, and its political thinking remained sound only so long as it kept in contact with the whole cultural life of the nation. Okay, now this is total bullshit. So which way do you want it? Do you want the military to be involved in political life or not, Herr Meinecke? Because the Prussian system, what you're criticizing it for is you're saying that they weren't thinking politically. It's like, yeah, they're a tool. They're the military. They're supposed to think tactically and militarily. the political system, the political leadership of the nation is supposed to decide on the objectives. And the Prussian general staff is actually a great example of the ideal, even the democratic ideal, the American ideal of separation of the military from the civilian side. They were removing themselves from all strategic foreign policy decisions and saying, we will accomplish the mission, whatever that mission may be, within the confines of what we can do. Isn't that exactly the ideal of classical liberalism? I mean, it's also the ideal of Nazism. The state, the military is supposed to be subordinate to the civilian or to the national leader or liberalism in the civilian state. So doesn't it make sense that if you're, say, someone like Schlieffen, the chief of the German, the Prussian general staff prior to 1905, responsible for the plan for the invasion of France in 1914, that you come up with a plan to fight everybody? That just makes sense, because you don't know what the Kaiser or what the chief of the state is going to, what mission he's going to present you with. Maybe you're going to have to fight everybody at once. Your job is just to come up with how to do it. Meinecke wants us to think that therefore, because the military, the technocrats, are coming up with plans that could do these things, that therefore they and their existence is responsible for the national leadership resolving on a war with everybody. That is not the case. And in fact, it's funny, because this attitude of this technical proficiency within the German military, the criticism that Meinecke is making actually ought to be applied to the Third Reich. Because the real criticism should be that the military in its technical proficiency constantly subverted Hitler's wishes, which led to the loss of the war, read David Irving. That's actually what they should be criticized for, that their arrogance in their own technical proficiency, in not all cases, but some cases, led to disobeying the highest warlord, Adolf Hitler, and not carrying through his strategic decisions, ironically. And at this also, I mean, this the way that if you want to criticize anybody for having too many technocrats with too much special knowledge taking over the state, well, I know he's writing in 1946, so he doesn't have the benefit of hindsight, but let's look at the last 80 years in America. Was it, who's that conservative nerd? Burnham, I think it was, who wrote the book about the technocrats taking over. I'm sure somebody knows what this is. I'm drawing a blank. But it is quite clear that now in America and in Western Europe, there is actually no national leadership. There is simply state by technocrats who don't have any objective other than their own perpetuation. So I find it mind-boggling that Meinecke wants to criticize the Prussian state and National Socialism for an overemphasis on technical ability within its specified realm. It's just ridiculous. And I guess I should give him some credit, because he's writing in 1946, maybe not literally, but metaphorically, with a gun to his head, so he has to say these things. Well, but he doesn't. He could have just shut his mouth. He's saying these things because he wants to get a job. That's my personal theory. So anyway, moving on, let's see some of his other arguments. I promised I was going to talk about the Jews. I mean, there's a ton of stuff in here, and I have a ton of notes on this. I really over-prepared for this lecture. I could talk about the stab in the back. I could talk about his arguments about reason. But let's just go straight to the fun part, which is the Jews. So Meinecke, like I said earlier at the beginning, he doesn't have a... He ignores the problem of Jewish money power, and he ignores the problem of international Jewish power. But he does talk about the Jews, and as you'll see, probably in a way that he wouldn't be allowed to today. So he says, page 32, "The Weimar Constitution, to be sure, did suffer from defects, even from a sound democratic viewpoint. It provided too little firm and continuous authority at the top of the governmental structure." You don't say. "And too great instability and dependence upon the shifting ups and downs of political parties. Even the parties of the Weimar coalition, or in the parties of the coalition, There were many unpleasant occurrences, short-sighted greediness for power, and not least in influence, the fact that the working men and other groups, he means the working class, and other groups now active had so long been deprived of a share of government and had so suddenly come into the enjoyment of power. Among those who drank too hastily and greedily from the cup of power which had come to them were many Jews. They appeared, in the eyes of persons with anti-Semitic feeling, to be the beneficiaries of German defeat and revolution. Everyone else in Germany, aside from these beneficiaries, seemed irrevocably consigned to misery. Well, that's funny you should mention that. I mean, I love how his wording there is. They appeared in the eyes of persons with anti-Semitic feeling. It's like, bro, you just said that they were indeed the beneficiaries of German defeat and revolution. You just said that. The previous sentence, among those who drank too hastily and greedily from the cup of power which had come to them were many Jews. Is that, does that not mean that they were the beneficiaries? Like, I don't know how you, I actually don't know how you write that sentence in 1946 and don't get like put in a camp. That's actually kind of amazing. I guess it's because of the bold face two side of how he just says the fact and then like draws the opposite conclusion from what the fact would actually lead to. Maybe that's how he gets away with it. Now, I did promise you that Meinecke had here one valuable observation. I said that was his point about nationalism and socialism being the two great ideas of the 19th century. And he observes that nationalism was more of a middle class ideology. You think of Germany in like 1848 or France in the early 19th century, and how nationalism was the desire of the upper middle class or the middle class to achieve more power for their nation and thereby through imperialism to get more money and have like the ability to expand and do more things and have more freedom because you have more power. That was the idea of nationalism, in a way. I mean, the other side of that too is just the idea of what we normally say when we say nationalism, the idea of bringing in all the people who speak the same language and who have the same cultural outlook and are of the same race into one nation. So nationalism is often used to mean both of those two things. But Meinecke is right here in observing that these two things, or that nationalism is generally a middle class phenomenon, or, well, back then it was, in the 19th century it was, and socialism was a working class phenomenon. So socialism is the desire to have equitable and reasonable distribution of the fruits of national success being distributed among the whole people. Like, there should be class cooperation between the middle class and the lower class, but there should also be a fair and square deal for the working man. That's the socialist ideal. And that these were the two primary ethical ideals in the 19th century, and that the key political problem of Europe in the late 19th and early 20th centuries was reconciling these two ideas. Meinecke goes to point out that there were attempts in Germany prior to Hitler to do this. One of them was by a guy by the name of Friedrich Naumann, who lived and flourished before World War I, and I think he died in the Weimar years. But he tried to bring these two things together and to elucidate a national socialism before Hitler. And this is interesting. I'm actually glad that I read Meinecke just for that nugget, because I went out and bought a book that... there's a German book on Friedrich Naumann that I happened to be at my a bookstore near me, so I went and bought that, but I haven't read it yet, so I can't tell you the details of Naumann's philosophy. But Meinecke is aware of Naumann as a precursor to Hitler and points out that here was somebody who thought deeply and worked a lot toward building a synthesis between the two great ideas. So let me go ahead and read you from Meinecke, page 5, where he talks about the nationalist wave and the socialist wave. He says, could the two great waves of the West remain in the long run separated from one another? Could there be anything but struggle and opposition between them? Right, because, you know, the nationalist middle class and the socialist lower class or working class are going to have to fight each other just because of differences of class interest, one would think. Or could some inner intermingling of them be successful? Such an intermingling, if it were attempted and failed, could indeed bring a frightful calamity upon the country and upon the whole world, as happened, in fact, in World War II. Well, yeah, okay, guy. One must admit, however, that each of these two waves, the nationalist and the socialist, could claim for itself a deep historical justification. They were by no means, as Jacob Burckhardt's ideas might imply, merely the offspring of this or that form of human greed. They were, on the contrary, instinctive groping efforts to solve the human problems resulting from a population increase everywhere unprecedented in history, blah, blah, blah. And a very similar anxiety was alive in socialism, though it sought a wholly different path for its alleviation instead of imperialism. Let us postpone until later the question... let us postpone until later the answer to the question whether, and if so, how the claim of one wave could be brought into harmony with that of the other, and fix our attention now upon the attempts actually made to intermingle the two waves. Okay, so here's where he goes into the history of Germany and Italy. And basically what he does is he accuses Italian fascism and National Socialism, German National Socialism, of being of destroying the individual. And again, like as I've pointed out to you, according to Hitler and Mein Kampf, you could probably find dozens of quotes where he talks about individualism, how it does not mean, how National Socialism does not mean the total destruction of the individual. This is an entirely straw man argument, and it is only something that you could believe if you were reading this in England or America or France and not in Germany. Actually, I don't think you could even believe it in France, because I think the French, having direct experience of the German occupation, would know that this isn't how National Socialism works. He goes on to compare... he says, a whole world of ideas hitherto faithfully revered, talking about like the older ideas of individualism in the West, was eclipsed by this authoritarian control. Ideals not only liberal and humanitarian directed toward the individual's freedom and happiness, but also old Christian ideals insofar as they aimed at the welfare of the individual soul. Okay, so now he's like... he's talking about individualism in two ways. Earlier, he's talking about individualism is a political thing. We need to have individualism is good because it can lead to the happiness in the individual. But then he's also talking about individualism as care for the individual soul as being important within a government. And I suppose I could go into an elaborate philosophical or historical refutation of that point. But I think all I need to do is point out the last 80 years and the fact that it's now okay for your kid to be a tranny. I mean, seriously, like, this is ridiculous. Oh, the individual soul. Nazism didn't care about the individual soul. No, liberal democracy doesn't care about the individual soul. This is just preposterous. Moving on. So another thing that Monica wants to complain about is another typical liberal conceit that National Socialist leaders weren't as educated as me, and they were so much more narrow than I was. So, page 36, Monica says, here we see, or here one sees, how a one-sided training of the intellect in technical work, again, back to that theme about technical work and the military and so on, may lead to a violent reaction of the neglected irrational impulses of the spirit, but not to a real harmony of critical self-discipline and inner creativeness, rather to a new one-sidedness that clutches about wildly and intemperately. Okay, so this is the, well, you just didn't like get the job that you wanted in architecture or painting, and therefore you decided to become a dictator. In many of the Nazi leaders, we believe we can recognize this type. Alfred Rosenberg, for instance, started as a technician and then plunged into that wild historical philosophical complex of ideas, which he proclaimed in the world to the world in Der Mythos des 20. Jahrhunderts, Myth of the 20th Century, his book, 1930-something. A technical calling, however, does not necessarily precede the world reformer's intemperance. Okay, so all this is like you're saying that technical education leads to this type of person. And I guess to give him the benefit of the doubt here, he's saying that the Prussian state, the pre-Nazi German state, the Prussian state, the Weimar state, but the Prussian influence within the Weimar state as well, led to this kind of person. Okay, well, but isn't that a criticism of that state as well? I mean, yeah, couldn't this criticism also be applied to Britain or France or America? An overemphasis on the technical leading to intemperance or leading to, I mean, taking him at his word here, taking his assumptions as they are, shouldn't we conclude that it is actually the fault of the state for overemphasizing technical proficiency? Well, I think he would want us to agree with that on the case of the Prussians. But how is that different from Britain or France? Was Britain like notable in its liberal education prior to? Was it great because of its liberal education prior to 1940, or was it great because of the technical ability of its bureaucrats and its navy and its industry, its captains of industry? Why was it great? Going on, men with hot heads, ambition, and an autodidactic urge for advancement, when forced into the technically normalized working conditions of the present day, may easily lose their inner equilibrium in the conflict of the spirit with the world about them and flare up in a blaze. Okay, so you're saying that it's not Hitler's fault that, assuming he was indeed given to this sort of intemperance, it's actually the conditions around in which he grew up that caused this thing. This isn't actually a criticism of Hitler. This is a criticism of the conditions that you think led to Hitler. The petty painter and acrylist Hitler, who once had to earn his scanty bread in construction work and in the course of it whipped up his hatred of the Jews into a general world philosophy of world-shaking consequences, is a case of this kind. Okay, well, fuck you, Meinecke. Like, let's read your biography. Let's look at you. You want to talk about narrow education? Let's look at you. So, Wikipedia. Meinecke was born in Salzwedel in the province of Saxony, Prussia. Attended school. Oh, so he's another. So he himself is if he thinks he's great, is a refutation of his own hatred of Prussianism. And attended school in Gymnasium Berlin. Educated University of Bonn, Friedrich Wilhelm University of Berlin. Okay, so total Prussian education. So you yourself, insofar as you think you are a worthy intellectual, are a refutation of your own thesis. Well, perhaps only an anecdote. In 1887-91, he worked as an archivist, professor, University of Strasbourg, served as editor of Historische Zeitschrift, 1896-35. 40 years. You were an editor for 40 years. And the chairman of Historische Reichskommission, 28-35, nationalist historian. Meinecke had little regard for the wishes of the people in Eastern Europe. I mentioned that earlier. And he went so far as writing about the raw bestiality of South Slavs while favoring German expansionism in the East, which I guess he wasn't willing to say in his 1946 book, Faggot. Going on. During the First World War, he advocated removing the Polish landowners, province of West Prussia, hated Slavs, okay, blah, blah, blah. In addition, he proposed the German colonization of Courland, ethnic cleansing, yada, yada, okay, whatever. But basically, what all this is to say is this guy was narrowly educated in academia. He knew academia and history. He had no experience in the military. He had no experience in the civil administration. He had no experience of technical work, history writing to him would have been technical work, but he had no experience of construction or mining or industry or art or any of these other things. Whereas compare that to Adolf Hitler. You fucking nerd. I mean, this is infuriating. I'm sorry. I shouldn't be so vulgar, but like, this is really infuriating that this single-mindedly educated nerd is criticizing Hitler, somebody who is generally knowledgeable, even according to modern, maybe not Jewish, but modern Judaized scholars, as being somebody who is knowledgeable about a wide range of subjects. He knew about art. He knew about architecture. He knew about music. He knew about history. He read a lot of history. It's very clear from reading Mein Kampf that he knew a lot of history. I read something on Metapedia the other day, so I can't confirm. Like, I think it was Metapedia was citing God, some historian, I forget, I'm sorry, but saying that Hitler at least could read English and French, even if he didn't like actively use them, he at least understood them. But regardless, Hitler is someone who is widely educated, has a wide experience of life and of actual things, whether it be the military in World War One, painting, being a construction worker, being a political leader, leading the whole world, the whole army, the whole state in World War II. He had the highs and lows of all life and many different fields of intellectual inquiry. Now, granted, he wasn't perhaps an expert at art. He wasn't an expert in architecture. He wasn't, because he, for whatever one reason or another, didn't have the opportunity to develop those faculties fully. But he proved himself to be, despite the loss in World War II, the greatest political leader, given what he had at his disposal, which is Germany, of the 20th century, arguably of the second millennium. So for this fucking nerd to say, oh, Hitler just, Hitler and the National Socialist leadership were single-minded and they weren't very well educated is like infuriating. I think I started autistically screaming when I read that. It's just, it's completely unforgivable. But, you know, I could, like, go through every sentence, every paragraph of this book and give you why I think it's absolutely retarded and infuriating. And that's why I cannot recommend that you read this book. If you want to peruse it, it's like, yeah, but the two actually useful observations from this book are, one, that nationalism and socialism were the two most important political and social phenomena of the 19th century, and that they needed to be reconciled in the 20th century, and that Hitler tried to do it and provided us, I mean, Monica wouldn't agree, obviously, but provided us a way to actually reconcile these two phenomena, which have been simply ignored in American and in English-speaking politics since 1800, because America and England really haven't developed politically or philosophically since 1800. And also that this fellow by the name of Friedrich Naumann was a theorist who, while he never had any great political success, at least was somebody who was thinking along these lines. And insofar as he failed to build a movement, I think we shouldn't judge him too harshly just because he was flourishing in the Wilhelm II period prior to World War One, and perhaps Germany wasn't ready for a National Socialist synthesis that early. Generally speaking, when states appear to be successful, societies are flourishing, they're not ready for radical change. It took the defeat in World War One and the coming about of Weimar for National Socialism to be something that people were willing to consider because they had recognized the failure of the previous system. But anyway, Naumann, I think, is one of those people that we should regard as, and I'm going to look into, because I thank Meinecke for pointing him out to me as somebody important, because he does seem like he must have been a valuable theorist. And Hitler does make that distinction in Mein Kampf between the theorist and the politician. The theorist is somebody who should be judged purely on the basis of the academic rigor and correctness of their system and not in how they've implemented it or their ability to implement it. So it's sort of the distinction between epistemology and, practical ethics or something. Like, Naumann must have been someone who apprehended a deeper truth but didn't have the opportunity or the political circumstances to bring it about. So, you know, one could go through this whole book, German Catastrophe, and just I could have autistic freakouts about many, many sentences in here. But I don't really find that terribly valuable or terribly interesting. I thought it was worth addressing this mainly because of that one core idea that nationalism and socialism were two of the key ideas in the 19th century, and that Hitlerism was and Naumann were attempts to synthesize these two. And then also just to address Meinecke's post-war copes, because these are the goyish and non-Jewish kind of conservative liberal attitudes about how we should look at World War II. And what's fundamentally wrong with them is a confusion of is and ought. So throughout the book, throughout these arguments, he's saying he thinks that Germany should have higher culture and Nazism brought about lower culture. Well, that's just wrong. That's just not true. The lower culture happened because of, it seems to have happened across all of Europe since about 1830. So we can't really say, well, Nazism came to power in 1930 and brought about a lowering of culture. And he refuses to acknowledge the two of the key facts of world history, which are Germany's geographical position, leading to the necessity of a stronger military and a high technical proficiency in its military and in its industry in order to serve the leader of the nation who must implement his policies in accordance with, well, he's put there by the people, and so he has to bring about, he has to ensure the racial survival of the people. And to do that, he needs the best instruments available to him. Well, the German general staff would be one thing. The German army would be another. A well-organized industry would be another. If you were to criticize, you see, if Meinecke wanted to be interesting, he would have criticized Wilhelmine Germany on the basis of its foreign policy and pointed out actually what was wrong with it. And in fact, Adolf Hitler did that. I think I mentioned this in the last episode or two, where I talked about Hitler's four solutions to German foreign policy from the perspective of 1900. See, Meinecke talks about the social problem, and Hitler talks about the social problem as well. The social problem being that increase in population since the Industrial Revolution. Well, what are the nations of Europe supposed to do with all these extra people? In Meinecke's opinion, he doesn't give a solution. He just says, well, Nazism is wrong when you just need to have liberalism. He just wants to wave his hand and wish away the Marxism problem and the problem of Jewish power, which he just ignores. So he doesn't have a practical solution at all. But when it comes to the social problem and its influence on foreign policy, Hitler gives a very clear exposition on how you deal with this, or how one could have dealt with it from the perspective of 1900 if Kaiser Wilhelm II and the people around him, like Bethmann Hollweg, were as far-seeing and as historically and politically astute as one would have liked them to have been. So Hitler's opinion is there's four possible ways to deal with the social problem, with the increase of population in Germany. One is you could do birth control like the French did. Hitler is against that because it would mean an arbitrary limiting of certain births, and he would prefer to see all children be born, and then this sounds cold, but that people just die in the struggle for life, or that the nation is forced to expand. In this first instance, that people just die because they're struggling for life and that only the stronger survive, and therefore that the entire race becomes stronger over time. And I know that sounds, from the liberal perspective, that sounds so cold, but it is really actually the merciful way to think about things because it ensures that the whole group becomes stronger over time. And I mean, hell, at least you're giving everybody a chance, right? You're letting them be born and try. You're not just killing them before birth. The other possible solutions would be to either pick a pro-Russian policy or a pro-England policy. The pro-Russian policy would necessitate, I'm skipping ahead. The second possibility would be simply to highly develop Germany's technical abilities and its industry, and thereby to allow an increase in population, or thereby allow for the feeding of, or the nourishment of, a larger German population. The problem with that policy is it would make Germany dependent on international trade. Well, if Germany's dependent on international trade, the British can just blockade Germany if they ever feel that Germany's a threat. So what Germany needs to do is either adopt a pro-British policy or a pro-Russian policy. And the pro-British policy would look like Germany would renounce the development of the Navy. It would renounce the development of technical industries that might cause the British to feel threatened. And it would focus exclusively on farming and on lower development, such as to allow Germany to expand to the east and have England at its back, and thereby to expand into the Russian sphere of influence and create more Germans, take more land, build up a bigger population, and thereby make Germany a international competitor with England and America. That's one possibility. Or it could do the opposite and team up with Russia, renounce expansion in the east, make sure it had the Russian side secure, and then build up a navy and build up technical industries, and then use that to compete with England and perhaps take land in Western Europe or overseas. And, you know, that's what Hitler said in Mein Kampf. And that what follows from that, sorry, getting back to the policy of Wilhelm II and why his policy made no sense, is that it follows, if those are your options in 1900, that you cannot possibly want alliance with Austria. Duh, because Austria is going to be at odds with Russia. So if you're making an alliance with Austria, you're already picking the side of Russia. And if you, what the most logical course of action for Germany in 1900 would be to ally with Italy, because really what Germany wants is to cut apart Austria and take the German-speaking parts of Austria into the German Reich. And then if it resolves on an Eastern policy, that it should then start picking up some of those smaller Eastern European states and Germanizing them. That would be the logical thing to do. But if you don't do that, then aligning with Austria prevents you from expanding. It prevents you from taking on those Germanic populations in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So it prevents you from increasing your nation state size. It also prohibits you from Germanizing some of those areas that are now under the control of the Habsburg monarchy. And it also draws you into war with Russia. Well, you don't want to have war with Russia. You want to have war with England if you have to have war with anybody. Or if you pick the English policy, the pro-England policy, and you want to expand to the east, well, you don't really need Austria. Austria doesn't actually help you. You still want to absorb the German-speaking areas from Austria. So, like, Hitler actually has a very cogent argument about what German foreign policy should have been in 1900 or before World War I in the 1890s, whatever, in order to achieve its economic and political goals. Meinecke doesn't have a recommendation whatsoever except for, well, we should embrace complicatedness. We need to have high culture like we did before, and all these political changes have inhibited the development of higher culture. Well, he's wrong there. The political changes haven't inhibited the development of higher culture. The presence of social or of Marxism and of Jewish power have brought this about. And in order to defend culture, you need to have political entities that are capable of fighting with Marxism and the Jews on their own terms and using their own weapons. It's just logical. It's very simple. So I really find Monica's book to be extremely shallow. And, you know, it's quite, one has to ask the question, why didn't he simply write this book in 1943 or 1934? You know, why didn't he write it when the NSDAP was in power? It's not like they were going to send him to a camp for writing this. I mean, he decided to wait until after the war to write this book. And his last chapter, he talks about his relationship with Ludwig Beck, the guy who was involved in the July 20th plot, 1944. And I guess Monica claims and history agrees that he probably didn't know about Beck's participation in the July 20th plot, but he praises Beck. But like, what did he do? He didn't even have the guts to try to overthrow Hitler and then blow his brains out like Beck did. So why would anybody take this guy seriously? In fact, it takes more guts today to criticize Jewish power and or to do anything to support anybody that, that criticized Jewish power, to stand up to Jewish power in even the smallest way, than it took for him to write this in 1946. So why should I take you seriously, Professor Monica? I don't know. I don't, actually. I guess that's the conclusion. I don't take you seriously. I don't take your book seriously. It was kind of a waste of time to read it. But, yeah, anyway, did I have any other conclusions before we wrap up here? Let's see what I had. Yeah, I mean, essentially, Monica's whole argument is just an apolitical. He simply fails to understand politics. He's like the libertarians. Libertarians only understand economics. They don't understand politics, and so they argue that if we just didn't have violence, then this would be possible. Or a pacifist argues, well, if we just didn't have war, then this would be possible. Monica is arguing, well, if we just didn't have the population explosion and industrialization and communism, then liberalism would be possible. It's like, bro, I don't care. That's stupid. Those ifs are stupid. Stop giving me ifs that aren't real. Let's take the ifs that are real. Given Jewish power, given Germany's geographical position, given the population explosion, Nazism follows. Your stupid liberalism does not follow. Oh, yeah, no, here's my last point. My last point is that just look at Europe today. All of the things that Meinecke is asking for in here, in terms of preferring culture over political organization developing of the people to assert their own right, their collective rights as a nation, as a race, this has led to Europe's current condition. Mass migration of non-whites, killing, murdering, raping, the total dominance of Jewish money, the domination of parliamentarianism and so-called democracy, which is to say no responsibility in leadership, just profiteering on the part of politicians and corporations, and sort of sick death of morals, and actually a coterminous death of culture. Where in Europe since 1945 has there been any culture? I mean, he complains about the 1890s. Like, my God, I wish I lived in the 1890s. Well, not really. I'd rather live in the 1930s, but the 1890s seemed like a paradise compared to today. I mean, the degeneracy of back then is like, all right, well, I mean, that's a little weird and pervy, but it ain't kids being trannies, that's for sure. So it is sort of wistful reading this 1946 book today, thinking, man, I wish I had those problems. I wish I had to complain about the 1890s. So yeah, I mean, I did read Monica's earlier book, or a good amount of it. I read some of Cosmopolitanism and the National State last year, and I talked about it a bit on the podcast I did with William called What is a People, I think it was called. And he had some actually more mature points and interesting stuff there. But again, he's writing in circa 1907, so he's writing under a free government, and he's writing as somebody who can say, you know, pretty much whatever, in 1907. 1946, he's a slave of the Americans and the Jews, so whatever. Anyway, that's all I've got for you today. I should make some show notes. So first of all, thank you to everybody who's been buying the show. I really appreciate it. And just so you know, the view counts that you see on the show are not nearly what I actually get. It's about for whatever reason, the view counts are about four times what the actual number of purchases are. So, I mean, I am making some money, but I don't want you to think that I'm making like thousands of dollars per episode, because I'm not. Also, another announcement. So a couple weeks ago, my book was published. It's called Sieg Heil, German for Beginners. And I've been working on this for about 3 years. It is a German textbook for Americans and Britons and Australians mainly. And it is designed for people, mainly for males, ages 15 to 30, but, you know, older could use it as well. And the main purpose of the book is to make language learning fun and interesting and give you a real structural idea of how language works. So even if you don't like learn German fluently, if you work through a good amount of the book, you should have a much better idea about how languages work. And I think that's important because I think language study has been uniquely neglected in the English-speaking world due to the predominance of English in international communication. And this has led to a degeneration of the English speaker's ability to think and to recognize equivocation and also to commune with his past, with people who wrote in different languages, other whites who wrote in different languages, and to understand that of his other racial brothers in Western Europe who have written in German, French, Italian, Nordic languages, Spanish, whatever else. So I don't want to shill my book too much, but if you are interested in foreign language and you want a book that is straight up pro-Hitler and has a little bit of humor in it, but is mainly focused on giving you a rigorous and logical understanding of how language works and applying that to German and picking up some good German reading ability, my book is what you want. And I do recommend that you use any language book or any language learning technique with other things so that you learn it. If you take classes in college, take a German class. If you, you know, pick up other books at a used bookstore or use Duolingo or some of the other online programs. But the advantage of my book is that it is very much focused on the structure of the language, and it is a very unique approach because it is the pro-NS approach, and everything in the book is talking about things that are of direct application to our current political struggle. It's the history of Germany, it's the culture of Germany, it's National Socialism, and it's Jewish power. So all of these things, these sort of questions that are of immense importance that are either neglected or talked about in a weird way today are talked about in the book. So I do think it'll be exciting if you choose to buy it. But enough of my shilling. I'll do some real shilling somewhere else. I just wanted to say that at the end of the episode. So again, thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have questions, feel free to post in the comments, or I think I posted my email on the Odyssey, which I lost the password to about a month ago. And so if I didn't respond to you from like months ago, it's because I lost the password. I recently reset the password. So you can email me. I think it was like Prussian Socialism at ProtonMail. Or you can just try Gregory Conti at protonmail.com as well. And future episodes, perhaps you're getting tired of the lectures. Lord knows I am. It's rather tiresome to lecture over the internet. I much prefer lecturing in person or discussing things. I do have a number of discussion episodes lined up with various people in the next, well, record over the next month or so. So whenever they come out, they'll come out. But I think I've got some exciting topics lined up, and I think you will enjoy them. So thanks for listening, and until next time, Sieg Heil.